stopped run. And one person is me. See what is back here. Fair enough. Okay. Right. So, Gerard Manley Hopkins was born in 1844, and probably when he was at university, when he was at Cambridge, he realized he was gay, and that proved a problem for him in terms of his value systems, his Victorian value systems, and probably because he wanted a stricter way of controlling his passions, as it were, he became a Jesuit. He became a Catholic and then a Jesuit. I don't know whether the Catholic Church is better or worse at making people feel bad about being gay, but that's another question. What we do know is that having been raised an Anglican, he was never negative or hostile towards Anglicanism. And in fact, two of his favorite poets were George Herbert, the great metaphysical religious poet who was an Anglican, and John Milton, who of course was a Puritan. So I don't know how John Milton, hello, would have felt about, oh, sorry, you come in, take a piece of paper, I don't know how John Milton would have felt about having a Jesuit fan, but we will never know because this is much later. Like Milton, Gerard Manley Hopkins liked to use homonymy to create resonance in his poetry. Now, what Milton tended to do is to use the Latin origin of words. So, abject can mean desperate in modern English, but it also means fallen from Latin, abjectus, thrown out, as it were. And so, Milton might, for example, describe Satan as abject with that double meaning. And that's basically because Milton wanted his poetry to be, to appeal to people with a ridiculous amount of education. Gerard Manley Hopkins wasn't worried about that. He wasn't really writing poetry for anybody he had, except perhaps his mother. He tended to send his poems to his mother on her birthday. But so he wasn't trying to make sure that uneducated people didn't read his poetry. And he used homonymy and even a homophony to create resonance, but from English words, which are homophones or homonyms, rather than from the Latin origins. When Hopkins was at Cambridge, he wrote poetry in Latin as well as English, and when he was in Wales in his seminary, in the seminario, he learned Welsh and started to write poetry in Welsh as well. Unfortunately, all of Hopkins' early poetry, he decided that he was too interested in poetry and burnt all his early poetry. A little bit like Christina Rossetti deciding to give up playing chess because she enjoyed winning too much. These people are taking their religion perhaps a little bit too seriously. But anyway, I mentioned the fact that he wrote poetry in Welsh because one of the aspects of Welsh poetry is what is called synhanedd. Synhanedd is a Welsh word, if you'd like, I will write it, if I can.
Don't start. I hate this kind of confusion. It's an animal. So sing. path. Can you read that one?
Tremendous quote, probably. Which is, of course, a Welsh word, and it describes a type of poetry, a poetic style that has a lot of internal rhyme, a lot of use of assonance, and a lot of use of alliteration above all, often not necessarily having end rhyme, but having more internal figures of sound. And the closest thing that we have in the English language to Singhanad is Gerard Manley Hopkins' poetry. So what we have, and what I'll talk about a bit later, is what we might call a sound tapestry. We have a type of poetry which, even if you don't understand a word of English, is slightly hypnotic in terms of its repetition and its playing with sounds. And that is, of course, intentional. All three of the sonnets that we are going to look at are from what are informally called the Welsh sonnets, because they were written in Wales, obviously, when he was at his seminary. Fortunately, his, what do you call somebody who leads a seminary? Is there a word for that?
Knows.
Yeah, but that's somebody who goes to. The person in charge? The priest in charge? Is there a word? But anyway, the priest in charge of the seminary managed to convince Gerard Manley Hopkins that it wasn't a terrible thing that he wrote poetry, and he could write poetry without it being a distraction from his religion. So he started writing poetry again, fortunately for English literature. So all of these poems were written between February and September 1877. Gerard Manley Hopkins was happiest when he was working with and helping the urban poor. Unfortunately, he was sent to be a school teacher, because he was obviously hugely educated, having gone to Cambridge, in Dublin. And he didn't particularly like teaching, and he felt very isolated as the only English person around him. Everyone else was Irish at a time when, obviously, being English, even being a Catholic Englishman, wasn't particularly popular in Dublin. And he died ridiculously young, at the age of 45. So he did not have a happy life, but he did produce, for me, the best poetry in the English language. So that's something.
Arecto.
What? Arecto. Arecto is the name, oh, okay. Right. I don't know in English, I used to say that, I'm afraid. So if we can look at the first one, we will look quite quickly at God's Grandeur and Starlight Night, and then look at the Windhover in significantly more detail. The Windhover is his most famous poem, and is absolutely phenomenal. So that's why we're going to spend more time on it. So, what type of poem is this? It's a sonnet, good. And it has some tendency towards being a Petrarchan sonnet, good. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shock foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then not read his rod? Okay. So, we start with a reference to electricity. Electricity, of course, has been seen as quasi-magical for a long time, for prehistoric times, if you're talking about lightning, things like static electricity, and there is that slightly fantastical ideas behind electricity in things like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So there is this idea that electricity is slightly magical, but the Victorians the one thing the Victorians love to do is to categorize things, and electricity would definitely, for the Victorians, be now part of science rather than part of religion and things like that. And the Victorian tendency is to try to separate these types of things into categories where they don't cause problems for each other. That is not Gerald Manley Hopkins' way. Gerald Manley Hopkins wants to address science directly and show that science is part of God's grandeur, is part of the expression of God's will on earth. So the world is charged with the grandeur of God. Can you see any hominemy there? Is there any hominemy in that first line? Charged has a number of different meanings. It can mean just energized. It can be like a battery that has been filled with power, potential power, and it can mean given responsibility for. Yeah, so if somebody's charged, could be their protegido. You could be charged with looking after a child or something like that. And all of those meanings are relevant. It flames out like shining from shook foil. So there's the idea there of when you have a piece of kitchen foil, papal albal, whatever you call it, or typically that type of metal sheeting, very, very thin metal sheeting, is used in scientific experiments as well. So there's a possible scientific relation there. But the idea that whenever you slightly move Pandoro or any other type of thin metal paper, you have that effect of light being scattered, like energy spreading out. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. What's it talking about, the ooze of oil crushed? What type of oil are we talking about? Yes, right. The type of oil that is crushed, that you get from crushing, is olive oil. Olive oil has, for time immemorial, been used for food, but also for medicine, in religious ceremonies, as a fuel for lamps, etc., etc. So we are comparing some of the oldest type of uses in religion with the most modern type of uses of electricity. So God can be found in something which is incredibly fast. Electricity moves faster than we can see the movement of it. Now, you can't see electricity travel through something that moves so fast. And something which is incredibly slow. If you're using a traditional press for oil, then oil comes out very, very slowly. But when you see oil being produced, when oil appears in a bottle, if there's any type of light going through it, it shines in the same way. So we've got very fast shine and very slow shine. Shine, brilliance, light are as a reflection of God in whatever type of shining comes out of it. Why do men then not wreak his rod? Wreck his rod, sorry. What does wreck mean? Wreck means, do you know the word reckless?
Yeah.
It's irresponsible. So, to wreck means to heed or to pay respect to, pay attention to. What about rod? What are the different ideas behind rod?
Authority.
It could be a stick of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lightning rod. So, the idea is that why the people, if you can see God in the fastest moving thing and very, very slow moving things, things which have light and value, all sorts of things around us, why do people not respect God's authority? But also, the rod idea takes us back to the idea of electricity, because we have the idea of a lightning rod, un conductor de electricidad. What is a lightning rod? A piece of metal which attracts lightning, so to take the lightning down to earth, so instead of burning houses and so. Yeah, a power range. Yeah. So, what is also being suggested here with the idea of the oozing metal is that there is a type of patient pressure, type of constant pressure. In essence, he is not describing his God. Hopkins' God is a very benevolent God, and he's not the type of God who is forcing anything. There's just a constant background pressure which produces results slowly. And so there is the insinuation there of patient faith in the way that people should practice their religion. So there's this idea that there is no division between what is scientific and what is religion. All things can be related back to God. So Hopkins ends with his big question, given all of that evidence, why do people not respect God's word? What is the problem with Victorian society? Again, a little bit like Dunn in his last years, Hopkins doesn't really care if you're an Anglican or a Catholic or whatever. It's much more important to be a Christian for Hopkins than to which particular denomination. People are, by this stage, are just beginning to grow up a little bit about making these massive differences over minute different doctrinal differences. And the answer is a complex one. And the answer comes in the second quatrain, or begins to come in the second quatrain. The second quatrain of the octave describes the state of contemporary human life. There is a blind repetition in human labor, and there is a sordidness in trade, in commerce. The landscape in its natural state reflects God as its creator. But industry and the prioritization of the economic over the spiritual have transformed the landscape and have robbed humans of their sensitivity to the few beauties that still remain. Shoes are mentioned because shoes are yet another thing that separate us from our direct contact with nature. So what we have with the Romantics is this idea that they begin to treat nature as an alternative to God. Nature is sublime, etc., etc. What Gerard Manley Hopkins says is, yes, nature is sublime. Nature is a manifestation of God. Nature shows God's goodness in the world. Generations have trod, and all is seared with train, bleared, smeared with toil. And wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. Shod means wearing shoes. So we have a situation where generations have trod. That's the monotony in that repetition implies the monotony of type the type of work that people do. And Gerard Manley Hopkins would have known that trod is to tread, trodden is pisar. But he would have known that etymologically tread is related to trade. And so there is the idea here of the monotony of modern life where what matters is trade, is commerce, etc., etc. And work has become toil. There is an important difference in German and there used to be in English between work, werken, which is creative, and toil, which is mindless work, which destroys your creativity. And of course, industrial work tends to be mindless. It tends to be something which is dirty and which is soul-destroying. It sears, it burns with trade. It blurs, it irritates the eyes. Yeah, bleared. Smear involves dirt on your hands. Not the clean dirt of working the land, but the greasy dirt of working with machines, working in coal mines, this type of thing. So it's the dirt of toil, not the dirt of working creatively. And wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. So we have this idea of people not smelling after a healthy day's work in the countryside, but smelling after or spending all day in a humid mine or working in a factory. Very different type of smell, the smell of smoke and soot and grime. The soil is bare now. This is the idea of land which has been emptied of nature, emptied of greenery, of plants, to build factories, etc., to build cities, nor can feet feel being shod. So you have a situation there where even shoes play a role in separating us from nature. Of course, traditionally, as in Spain, for your grandparents at least, people didn't get their first pair of shoes until they were 10 or 11 or 12 or that sort of thing. People went barefoot while they were innocent children, just going about playing. And even when you had children working in factories and things like that, they often were barefoot. The only place where that's still the case is New Zealand, where a lot of people still go around barefoot because that's what they do. But the idea that everybody wears shoes is a relatively modern idea. So there is in the perfect iambic pentameter of that first line, generations have trod, there is the idea of monotony, of weariness. And that is to do with the modern world, but it's also something that is built up over generations. It's not just saying our generation is terrible, how bad we are. It has been a process. Yeah, he is now involved in the high period of the Industrial Revolution, but it has been going on to some extent for nearly a century by the time that he's writing this. So, modern society, by its mechanization, by all the emphasis on commerce and work, etc., etc., turns its back on God and is therefore soulless, etc. In the sextet we have, and for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and though the last light of the dark west went, oh, morning, at the brown brink eastward, springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and our bright wings. So what's he talking about here? Where have you seen the word brood before? Exactly 1 year ago, studying Paradise Lost. To brood can mean something like poner moros, but that's not what it means here. To brood is what a mother bird does when sitting on her eggs. So to brood is como incubar or something like that, eggs of a bird, to incubate. But Milton talks about God brooding over the world. So this idea of care and protection is something that Milton uses in line 21, if I remember correctly, of Paradise Lost. God looking after the world. So nature is never spent. What is the homonymy of spent? What does spent mean? Okay, so gastar in the sense of use money. Nature does not participate in the economy. Yeah? Nature is never spent, but spent also means exhausted. Yeah? Nature cannot be exhausted by this alienation process. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. So in the essence of things, there is a natural freshness. Even if superficially everything is dominated by commerce, by economics and by trade, in the essence of things, in the deep down in things, there is freshness. And though the last night off the Black West went, oh, what is that a reference to? The last light off the Black West went. Although night time comes, yeah, night time, the last light is the twilight, like that night falls, yeah, we go into night time, even though that occurs, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Every night is followed by a morning. You have morning following night time, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods, because the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, is incubating the world with his warm breast. So there's this idea of nurture, divine nurture of nature. And with our bright wings. What's with the O and R? Yeah. So, O and R. R is the equivalent of Alpha, and O is the equivalent of Omega. I am the Alpha and the Omega. You have this idea that Christ, or the Holy Spirit, is gestating, is incubating the world, and in the moment the people reconnect with nature and therefore reconnect with God, these religious forces, Christ or the Holy Spirit, will be there ready and waiting to receive people. So, it is a positive sonnet about how regeneration is possible if people change their mindset. And of course, really quite an ecological poem. The idea that, yes, you can dedicate yourselves like a good angler to working as hard as possible, working 10 hours a day. The most important thing in your life is your work. But in fact, that isn't going to be very fulfilling in the end. And what is fulfilling is on the spiritual side of things, and one way of connecting with the spiritual side of things is through nature. So this poem doesn't have the sprung rhyme, which is going to be one of our magic words, that Hopkins is famous for, but it does diverge significantly from what you might expect normally from a sonnet. For example, in his question, why do men then not reach his red? We could read that as an iambic pentameter. We could read that line as crushed. Why do men then now not reek his red? So an iambic pentameter with initial inversion. But the sound parallelisms suggest that that line should be slowed right down and basically become prose. Because we have men and then, which rhyme, we have now and not, which rhyme, and we have wreck and rod, which rhyme, it looks like what Gerard Manley Hopkins really wants is five stressed syllables continuously. In order to do that, we have to almost slow the sentence down to a stop. Why do men then now not wreak his rod? Putting a great deal of emphasis on that question, which is presumably what the poet wants. But you can see there that there is a massive amount of figures of sound. We have grandeur of God, alliteration, shining from shook, alliteration, gathers to a greatness, partial alliteration. Men then, internal rhyme. Now not, alliteration. Wreck is rod, alliteration. And we could go through and do the same sort of thing in the rest of the poem. Seared, leered, smeared. Man smudge, man smell. Where's shared? So where's man smudge, shares man smell. That level of sound parallelism is the sort of thing that you would expect from our friend Sinhamed from Welsh poetry. And again, it begins to create this situation where you have the feeling of a sound tapestry being created. Right.
I've heard some of some pieces of poetry by Spoit and read by Chabot. And he speaks so fast. And when he sings along like a song, it's a very strange kind of song.
Yeah, I mean, in this particular case, it's probably a very good idea that it's read by Richard Burton, because he is Welsh, and so some of his inflection, some of his accent is Welsh. It depends. Obviously, native speakers are likely to read poetry faster than you are, but you just have to listen a number of times, I suppose. If you're just rushing through the thing, then that's not a good thing. But, I mean, if he's giving sense and giving the proper stress to words, then why not? If you are, there's a sort of tendency, certainly an American tendency, to sort of ham act poetry. And so to speak poetry very slowly and take every word seriously. And that's just a bit silly. So, I mean, obviously there's a balance between the two. But since those were professional recordings, I imagine he was coached for that. I mean, obviously he's a trained actor, but he was a trained actor. But presumably there was a coach anyway talking him through it as he did it. So, I'd have to hear the specific case. But I would be reluctant to criticize him, because the poetry that I've heard him reading, he reads very well. So, I don't
know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you will notice there is, because he will be reading it properly, is the enjambment will mean that he's not respecting the lines at all. But that's how it should be read. Okay, well, I'll try not to read it too fast, but the starlight night. Look at the stars. Look up at the skies. So look at all the fire folk sitting in the air. The bright burrows. The circle citadel there. Down in the dim woods, the diamond bells, the elves eyes. The grey lawns, cold where gold, where quick gold lies. Wind beat white beam. Airy abels set on fire. Flake doves set floating forth in a farmyard scare. Ah well, it is all a purchase. All is a prize. Buy them, bid them. What? Prayer, patience, arm, vows? Look. Look. A May mess, like on orchard's boughs. Look. March bloom, like on mealed with yellow salads. There are indeed the barn. Within doors house the shocks. The price bright paling shuts the spouse Christ home, Christ and his mother and all his hallows. So, what is the most obvious aspect of anaphora there? Look. This poem is basically just saying, look. If you actually look at things, you can see the presence of God in pretty much everything, not just in foil and olive oil, but in all sorts of things. Now, Plato has his big idea of higher reality being like shadows, well, we can only perceive like shadows in a cave, yeah? Going to Plato's cave, blah, 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 you all know about that. The concept of Gerald Manley Hopkins is much more that we catch glimpses, ibistathos, you see momentary visions of the higher reality rather than shadows of it. And those momentary glimpses are like the holes in the veil that separate us in the Neoplatonic sense from God. So look at the stars. Look up at the sky. One of the ways in which we can see the presence of God is in looking up in a wonderful, unpolluted place like North Wales, where nobody lives because it's full of mountains and wealth people. So there's very little light contamination, and you can, if there's no clouds, which occasionally there are no clouds, you can see a massive amount of stars. Like in Extremadura or something like that, and in less populated parts. Look at all the fire folk sitting in the air. So he is interpreting the stars as fire folk, this type of angels in a sort of Blakean sense. There is quite a lot of Blake and Blake's attitude to religion and nature in Gerald Manley Hopkins. The bright burrows. What are burrows? What's a burrow? District of Municipal. Yeah. So I used to live in the London borough of Islington. So one of the major divisions into which the city is divided. So I suppose things like Chamberí or Arganzuela would be boroughs in that sort of sense. So seeing the fact that you could see the stars at night with their relative concentrations and their relative isolations. It's very much like if you're in the mountains and you look down on the valley, you will see concentrations of light where there are towns, and occasional isolated light where there are isolated farms. And so what is above reflects what is below in that sense. The circle citadels there. Again, they're like towns with their castles, with their citadels in the skies. Down in dim woods, the diamond delves the elves' eyes. So, as we have in the sky, which is dark, we also have in what is the darkness of forest, in the dim woods, the dark forest, you also have little flashes of light, especially where you have the people digging for minerals, and you have the same way that you have the stars in the sky, you have diamonds under the earth, deep in the ground. So as you have in the sky, you have under the earth as well. The grey lawns, cold where gold, where quick gold lies. As at dawn, at sunrise, the landscape seems to be drained of colour, certainly in England. So it almost looks like things are in black and white. What are areas of grass, most of the green is not visible because of the nature of the light. It looks very, very grey. It's very grey-green. But as the sun appears, you suddenly have the flashes of dew, of rothium, on the grey lawns. And so you have the same being reflected in the skies, as underground, as in the woods, as on ground in terms of the lawns in the morning. Quick gold, by the way, is an invention of Manley Hopkins. What's it based on? What similar word is he referring to? Quicksilver. What is quicksilver? Mercury. So we have the idea that pyrites are fool's gold. Yeah? We talk about fool's gold when we talk about something which looks like gold but is not gold. But we talk about quicksilver. In both cases, it's partly because of the figure of sound. But anyway, that's not important. But he doesn't want to talk about fool's gold because this isn't fool's gold. This, if you like, gold is fool's gold. The idea that what is important in life is riches is for fools. What is important in life is it being receptive to these manifestations of God, which you see in flashes, in the most ordinary type of beauty. So it's not fool's gold, it's quick gold, what we have when you see the beauty of a landscape. Winds beat white beams. White beams and abeels are both types of trees which have a very different colour on the top of the leaf from on the bottom of the leaf. And this means that when the wind hits against these types of trees, you have some flashes of changes of colour, which again imitates the process that we have above in the sky, below ground, or at ground level, and also at tree level. Everything is connected there. Flake doves set floating forth at a farmyard scare. And you have a similar sort of flashing process when you suddenly have a goose or a chicken which is frightened in a farmyard, and you have the flapping of wings. So this is something which affects animal, vegetable, and mineral, all aspects of nature. Ah, well, it is all a purchase, all is a prize. It's not absolutely clear what he's referring to here, but either he's suggesting that people don't pay attention again to this because of the purchase or the prize, Or he's suggesting that there is a simple relationship where you choose to participate in these things, you choose to accept the prize of seeing God in nature by rejecting the values of commerce. It's very spiritual and very unworldly. But if you're a priest, you can be unworldly. You don't have to worry about paying the rent and things like that. I wouldn't say that they sort of just because there's. I mean, the problem for both these romantics and people like Jeremiah Hopkins is, of course, Darwin. Darwin says, stop being silly about nature. Nature is violence, nature is cruel, and if you don't win in nature, you are dead. Nature is not beautiful and sublime and all these sorts of things, or it can be, but it can only be that if you're part of the winning species. If you're part of the losing species, there's nothing beautiful and sublime about nature. But the difference is, especially with people like Shelley, that nature becomes an alternative to God. Not so much with Blake, and it's not very clear with Wordsworth, although to some extent nature is an alternative to God with Wordsworth. Whereas what Hopkins is saying is that nature is God, and God is nature, and that's where you see God, the majesty of God, if you know. I don't think you could say in either case it's accepting nature as it is, because yes, nature is wonderfully impressive if you are going walking in the Matterhorn, you know, in the Alps, and looking at glaciers and things like this. But if you're in southern England on a rainy February afternoon, there's nothing sublime about it, it's just unpleasant. But Jeremiah Hopkins is the difference, probably. Okay, an important difference is that he is open to see the glorious elements of nature without them necessarily being sublime. They don't have to be grandiose. They don't have to be Etna in eruption. It could be just the dew. The fact that when the soil has been turned over by a plough, something very, very simple. And it's that receptiveness that's important within you, rather than necessarily finding nature, which is, because there's a problem with the sublime, with sublimity. And that's that it tends to, where it tends to lose its potency. If you spend your whole time looking for sublime nature, then you reach a point where it stops impressing you, just because there's a limit, and you get accustomed to things. Whereas if what you're doing is being receptive to the beauty and detail, then that's probably limitless. So there's a difference in that sort of aspect as well.
So when
and the idea there is to be constantly looking for the sublime, for sublimity, whereas that's not necessary here. I don't know, there is obviously an influence of romantic poetry, but I don't think because the primary importance is God, and because there isn't that emphasis on the sublime, I don't think we could call him directly a romantic poet. It is possible that this poem is also partly the result of a disappointment. We know from Jeremiah Hopkins' letters that he missed the total eclipse of the 28th of February 1877. So there was a total eclipse that year. And unfortunately, the people who are around him, the people in the seminary, and the Welsh people around him, were not interested in this type of thing. He was massively interested in anything, basically. So this was a huge disappointment that nobody told him there was going to be a total eclipse, which he would very much have liked to see. So there's this idea of being being aware of, paying attention to the sky. No, wrong way around. Okay, so Gerard Manley Hopkins himself said that the Windhover was the best thing I ever wrote. So he should know. And I would thoroughly agree with him. So, let's start by looking at the octave. I called this morning, morning's minion, Kingdom of Daylight Dauphin, Dappledorn drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off forth on swing, as a skate heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, and hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achiever, the mastery of the thing. Absolutely wonderful. Okay, so let's take that in stages. The title is The Windhover. What is a Windhover? It's a type of halcyon, it's a kestrel. It is a particular type of hawk, of a halcyon, that has the ability to remain motionless in the wind when it's looking for prey, which presumably is a big advantage. Windhover is a dialect word for the bird. Another dialect word is windfucker. If he had used that, of course, he would have completely ruined the poem. Fortunately, he used windhover. The poem describes how early one morning he saw one of these birds hovering in a field. Hover is to stay vertically. Without moving, yeah, to stay in one place. The word strikes the poem as the darling of the morning. Minion can mean servant, but it's in its French origin, it means favorite or darling. So this is, if the morning is personified in this case, the morning is the kingdom of the daylight dauphin. It is a prince of the morning. Dappledorn drawn falcon. There is a double idea here. The falcon, the hawk, can be drawn in the sense of pulled out, pulled against the wind, or it can be drawn in the sense of being a silhouette against the dawn. So it is dappled in the sense that it has some light, dark effects on it. In his riding of the rolling level underneath him, steady air. So the air is constantly moving. There's not a single air current. The air is not still. The air is in constant and changing motion. It is the brilliance of the bird that manages to maintain it in exactly the same position, despite the movement of the air. And that idea of the bird riding the air and staying in the same position, despite the movement of the air, is reflected in the fact that kingdom is divided between two lines. It's like the bird jumping between two currents of air, but staying in the same place. It rides the air like a horseman, like a jinete, moving steadily with controlling the horse by using the reins. So we have the idea of the hawk being a horseman controlling his or her horse. And that idea of the horseman will come back later when we look at the Chevalier. So there's the idea, to some extent, that this animal has medieval connotations. Yeah? Dauphin is not something that exists in contemporary France. The French, what we have in France at the time, is a republic. The Dauphin is a medieval French title. And striding high there. So there's this idea that it is also walking on air. How he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. So to ring upon the rein has a number of connotations. One of the connotations is to maintain a certain tension on a long rope when you're training a horse and it's going around in circles. But it can also mean to pull the reins of the horse in tightly, so you're tightly controlling the horse as you ride the horse. For example, doing dressage, where the horse is staying in the same position, but moving on its feet. So there's movement to stay stationary. There is a metaphor of dressage there. On a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. What does wimpling mean? So that's the idea of rippling. It's the idea of movement of water. So the way that the wings are moving, like the movement of water. There's a very subtle movement across the wings to maintain them in their particular state of ecstasy. Wimple is also the place where people are most likely to see the word wimple is in the description of, you know, those funny nuns' hats that go sort of, I don't know which denomination they are. I'm not sure you have them in Spain, but they sort of would associate them with the sound of music and things like that. There's a type of German nuns who have their thing go, woo, yeah? That is a wimple because it is wave-shaped. So there is a little bit of a connotation of that. Then off forth on swing, so there's the idea of swing, of oscillating in the air like a columpio. As a skate heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend. So we have the idea of somebody skating on a river and describing a curve. So the smoothness of movement of somebody moving in two dimensions when they're skating on ice around a river curve, a bow bend, is similar to this third movement, curved movement in the sky. The hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. So the bird is initially negating the great wind which is moving against it, but then can go very quickly against the wind, rebuffing the wind, and move in the direction it wants. It has complete control of its movement in the sky. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird. What's he talking about here? What is the metaphor in stir? It means to move, to suddenly move. The idea is that his heart is like a small animal, which is the prey, the quarry of the falcon. So in the situation where the falcon is hovering and then diving, there's a moment where the prey will bolt. who suddenly run off and try to escape. And he is comparing his heart some at this dramatic fall of the bird to the stirring of a small animal, and how impressed he is, if you like. Here he is probably finding a level of sublimity, the achiever, the master of the thing. What he is describing here is, if you like, Darwinistic. He is describing how what happens when an animal does exactly what it has been designed to do. If you want to, if you want somebody to write poetry, don't ask a windhover. If you want somebody to cook you supper, don't ask a windhover. But if you want something to hover in the sky and then fall incredibly quickly on its prey, to do its specialization in nature, its survival of the fittest element, its Darwinistic element, how it achieves its competition in nature, then you can see that. So what, to some extent, what Jeremiah Hopkins is saying is, yes, animals are perfected and designed to, for a particular function in nature. Animals specialize. And yes, that specialization is also a reflection of God. Darwin does not negate God, and Darwin didn't want to negate God. Darwin was a good Anglican. Darwin was a Christian. And what Jeremiah Hopkins is saying is that there's no problem in that. That greatness, that impressiveness of seeing any particular animal doing something, the extraordinary thing that every animal does, has something extraordinary that it really does, is also a reflection of God.
And the part of the transformation,
Well, it doesn't really matter if it has specifically made a kill. The fact of seeing the falcon maintaining itself still and then falling like a bolt, most of the time they don't actually catch something. They catch something every 4 or 5 times they do that. But the fact of seeing it doing that, doing something which is absolutely incredible, which at that time certainly is, I mean, maybe people have drones now that can do that, but at that time is something that is completely beyond human possibility. Obviously, people are flying in balloons, and they will soon be flying in airplanes. But that level of control of being able to stay absolutely stationary in the sky and then drop like that, I mean, even a helicopter cannot do that, have that absolute control over movement that a falcon does, that a kestrel does. Brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, oh my chevalier. So this causes quite a lot of problems, this tercet, as you can imagine. The opening of the sextet serves both as a further elaboration of the bird's movement and an injunction of the poet's heart. The beauty, valor, and act, like air, pride, and plume, here buckle. What does buckle mean? This is probably the key word in the sonnet. What does to buckle mean? What's a buckle? Yes, but that doesn't help us very much. Okay, good. A buckle is an erbia. So buckler, el bucle, this is erbiero. But that doesn't help us very much either. To buckle is to fold in on itself, which is where we get the word buckle, meaning that, is to collapse in on itself, implode, if you like. So suddenly, the bird, from being something which is controlling the air and staying stationary, closes in to make itself a ball, in the same way as Andrew Marvell describes the lovers making a ball when they fall into his coy mistress. There's this idea of falling like a ball out of the sky. And of course, we have that idea of Bako forming a ball, the ball being a perfect shape, etc., etc. And the fire that breaks from me. So there's an imagination. So he imagines fire coming out of this bird which is hurtling towards the ground. A billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. So what's he talking about now?
Yeah.
Right. And who's he referring to now with my chevalier? The bird? And through the bird? Christ. Right. So the Dauphin, the morning Dauphin, is the bird, but it's also Christ. And there's this idea, you have, for example, in Piers Plowman, one of the weird medieval concepts was to describe Christ as a knight in shining armor. Bit weird, but anyway, not completely in concordance with Christian values, but we won't worry about that. So there's the connection between the bird as the rider controlling the horse, and now the bird is the chevalier, the knight in shining armor, which is also Christ. But Christ is a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous. If the bird is dangerous for the prey, the bird has a propensity to catch the prey because of its perfect design, because of evolution. Christ is infinitely more dangerous. Christ always catches the prey, his heart, whenever he chooses to. So the final tercet. No wonder of it. Sheer prog makes plough down cillium shine, and blue bleak embers, ah my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. So, no wonder of it. This isn't actually that extraordinary. You can actually see this in the most everyday thing. All you have to do is observe. All you have to do is to look at nature, even to look at people, and you will see the most incredible things. It's a question of attitude. Sheer plod makes plough down cillium shine. What's that referring to? It's a complicated phrase, but the idea is that when a plough cuts through the earth, you have to imagine that you're in Wales. Okay? When the plough cuts through the earth, probably the surface of the earth is slightly grey-brown, because if it hasn't rained. But if it cuts through the earth and turns it over, the earth sparkles back because it has water in it, it has minerals in it. And so that process of the plough turning the earth over creates the sparkling effect like the starry night sky, etc., etc., etc. But, incredibly, it also means that the plough doesn't rust. The fact of using the plough, metal mobile plough that turns the earth, keeps the plough shining. It means that it doesn't oxidize. That is also, so it is a perpetuating process. The earth, the use of the plough makes the earth shine because it turns the earth over, and it also makes the plough shine. So we have a virtuous circle of shining between the two things. And there's a wonderful story in one of Jeremiah Hopkins' letters, where he was travelling through the countryside in one of the seminary's coaches, carriages, and he said, "Stop the carriage! Stop the carriage! Stop the carriage!" and he jumps out of the carriage and he convinces a local ploughman to let him have a go. So there he is using the plough and learning about what this means. And of course, there's a huge amount of symbolism in being a ploughman. The ploughman is the only fully virtuous, or the only one of two fully virtuous pilgrims in Pilgrim's Progress. Pious ploughman is, of course, the symbol of the virtuous Christian. And when does the ploughman weary homeward tread? Weary homeward tread.
In the churchyard.
Yes, in the churchyard. Whose elegy? Gray. Gray's elegy. Excellent. Very good. There is the idea that in Gray's elegy, that there's this idea of the ploughman exhausted at the end of the day going home. And what is the one of the fundamental messages of Gray's elegy? Everybody's the same at the end. Why? Because all human activity leads but to the grave. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. Everybody is equal in death, and we all end up dead. So basically, the elegy is saying that there is death in everything. Hopkins is making reference to this, but saying exactly the opposite. There is life, there is beauty, and there is God in everything. And blue bleak embers, ah, my dear. Where does ah, my dear come from? It's a difficult question. Any idea? That comes from a poem by George Eliot on love. And blue bleak embers, what are embers?
What's left in the fire.
Right. So, what's left in the fire when it looks like the fire has died. But blue bleak embers are, my dear, fall, gall themselves, break open, and gash gold vermilion. So, if you imagine, we've all had the occasion to be watching a fire when it's almost dead, and then one part breaks off, and you see that inside there is gold vermilion, there is intense orange, gold, red colours because it is still burning on the inside. That, for Jeremiah Hopkins, is Christ on the inside. So, we have... let's see. Taking those last words, no wonder of it, sheer plod may plough down Cillian. Cillian's a slightly specific agrarian word, but probably would be much better known at the time when more people had contact with the. And blue big embers, ah, my dear, fall gall themselves, more or less, gash, perfectly normal English word, gold vermilion. Vermilion is a slightly specific colour, but it's a perfectly correct colour. So a lot of the words that you will find more difficult, like blear, sear, smear, embers, gash, are actually very, very normal Anglo-Saxon type words. So it's a slightly more extended vocabulary, but it's extended perhaps more towards normal, perhaps slightly dialectical sometimes words than the more, one of the problems is, of course, it's probably easier for a Spanish person to read a legal contract than to read the Daily Mail. Or if you wouldn't want to, then. A lot of the vocabulary will come out in a typical article in a sensationalist, shitty newspaper, like the Daily Mail or the Sun or something like that, will actually be much more everyday language, will be much more difficult for you than the Latinate or Frenchified language that you're going to find in a more elevated context, if you like. So yeah, I mean, you're going to understand probably better the Daily Telegraph or the Guardian or something like that than one of the more populist newspapers. Right, so we can look through that and see an absolute constant process of creating a sound tapestry with I caught this morning, alliteration, morning's minion, repetition, morning's minion, consonants, kingdom of the daylight's dauphin, alliteration, dapple dawn drawn, alliteration, and internal rhyme. Dapple dawn drawn, falcon in his riding and rolling, level underneath him, steady air, and striding high, alliteration. How he rung upon the rain, alliteration and partial or near consonant of a wimpling wind, also wimpling wing, where we have alliteral assonant, etc., etc. It's absolutely constant. But it's not constant in a sort of, in a sort of nonsense sense of just making words associate words by the sound. There is a very, very long and difficult process of finding words, because a lot of these words at the same time that they are forming sound parallelisms are also that you were using the homonymy to create resonance in terms of their meaning. So what we're creating is an intensely structured thing where there are levels of meaning which you get after studying the thing for a long, long time. And every time you read one of these poems, you can actually get more out of it. The more you invest in the poetry, the more you get out of the poetry, which is why Jeremiah Hopkins is God. Absolutely wonderful. Then there is an intentional level of ambiguity. There's a level, as with Blake, there's what you want to see in the poem as well, what you want to get out of it. He's not trying to be clever. There's actually no interest in publishing these poems. These poems are published 40 years after his death by a friend of his who had copies of them because he sent them to his friends. He made absolutely no attempt to publish them in his lifetime. He died completely unknown.
And he thinks
he believed his not much further than the friend who published them in 1921 and his mother. Not very much at all. I mean, he was completely unknown until the poems were published in 1921, I think it was, and very, very quickly a number of people, I think including, for example, T.S. Eliot, decided that this was just the best poetry that had been written by the Victorians, and nobody had realized. In his lifetime, he died in a poetic sense, a complete failure. Well, you would say a complete failure, but he made no attempt to be a success. So he wasn't really interested in this. This was a hobby. But his life was being a priest, and the purposeful part of his life was helping the poor in places like Manchester. The unfortunate part of his life was teaching Irish schoolboys, which he didn't really enjoy. But of course, you know, you have to do what you're told to do if you're in a military organization like the Jesuits. So that was unfortunate. We have 3 minutes and we don't really have very much more. But there's this idea that if the majesty and the meaning of people is when people discover their vocation and discover their moral vocation. So in the same way as the majesty and the falcon is when the falcon is doing what falcons should do, the majesty of a falcon is not being in a zoo or being in a wildlife park where you have some trainer, you know, calling the falcon comes, chases a bit of beans on the end of the thing. The majesty in nature is seeing nature do what nature does. And the majesty of people is when they are following their moral vocation. Everybody has their creative potential. And if that creative potential is also part of their moral potential, that is when people achieve true greatness. You don't achieve true greatness by getting a six-figure salary. You don't achieve true greatness by just being the President of the United States because you want to be the President of the United States. Even if you have absolutely no vocation for this, you just want to be popular. Your true vocation is when you're doing something which is useful, is creative, and is moral. The subtitle to Christ the Lord isn't actually part of the original poem. He added this to make the thing clearer, if you like, 3 or 4 years after he wrote the poem. There is that definitely that Christian element in it, but I'm not suggesting that he changed the meaning of it, but it makes explicit what to some extent was implicit. Blah, 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 blah. No, not a huge amount. No, not a huge amount. Well, he unfortunately burnt the first part of his production of poetry and stopped writing completely for 7 or 8 years while he thought this was not good for his Christian process. So, I mean, what we have is not, it's not a massive amount of poetry, but it's gold. What we have is absolute gold. There are some longer poems, like The Sinking of the Deutschland. There was a ship which sank in, just sank in bad weather conditions. A passenger ship called the Deutschland in 1876 or something like that. And on board the ship were a number of nuns. So this poem is about the ship going down and the loss of these nuns. Which is a longer one. A lot of them are relatively short. In the same way with Thomas Gray, you don't have to write a huge amount of poetry to be a great poet. You just have to get it right once or twice. Good. Okay. Well, that's it. You have 4.5 magic words, which you should be very, very clear about. Sprung rhyme, sprung rhythm, inscape as a noun, inscape as a verb, and instress. You have definitions there. You look at those definitions. You learn those definitions. They are complicated concepts, and a bit nightmarish, but all you have to do is understand the concepts enough so that if they appear as magic words, you will be able to identify them as magic words and write whichever. Yeah. It's in the notes. Work on that with the object. But inscape and instress. Okay? Sprung rhyme, sprung rhythm, inscape and instress. And those words are Jeremiah Hopkins' words, and there should be a mention of his name specifically if the DAC gives you those as a magic word. I mean, I suppose you could talk about it without it being a direct reference to his poetry, but really, he should mention Jeremiah Hopkins in the magic word, and that is 1 point, 10%. You pass the exam, magically, if you get that right. So, make sure that you are...